So this evening I have a talk for you, and it's got two titles. So the first title is The Buddha Beyond Siddhartha. But if you don't like that one, you can have The Buddha, Mara, and the Cosmic Perspective. Okay, we're going to start off. We're going to begin with a battle. We're going to begin with the battle of good and evil. The battle for good and evil, the battle between good and evil, sometimes you could call it. Now, this battle of good and evil is a wee bit out of fashion at the moment. It was well in fashion, it was high up there in the mid-70s. George Lucas brought it to our attention very excellently, yeah? So that battle, that particular manifestation of the battle was fought in the Star Wars. I always call it the Star Wars trilogy, and that really shows where my allegiance lies. But anyway, the Star Wars films. So there was the Galactic Empire and the Rebel Alliance, yeah? And George Lucas wrote the Star Wars films really well. He employed archetypal characters, and they enabled us to project ourselves into the action, yeah? Or we could really get alongside these archetypal characters. So that was a manifestation of the Battle of Good and Evil. There's another TV version of the Battle of Good and Evil that I'm really fond of, which is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, evil is big and organised, yes? It's got a good budget. So somebody within the rank, somebody within the minions of the dark side is really excellent at filling out funding applications, yeah? Because they've got so many means at their disposal. And the good side is always smaller and weaker, less well organised. And in the Bodhicharyavatara we have the power of good is always weak, while the power of evil is vast and terrible. Yeah? Now I'm going to just skip back a bit and read you the verse before that. At night, in darkness thick with clouds, a lightning flash gives a moment's brightness. So sometime, by the power of the Buddha, the mind of the world might, for a moment, turn to acts of merit. This being so, the power of good is always weak, while the power of evil is vast and terrible. What other good could conquer that were there not the perfect awakening mind? So, the world is in darkness. So let's imagine that from that darkness, as it says in the text, there's a lightning flash. And that lightning flash is the birth of a boy child into the Shakyam clan. Yeah? So this boy child is born in what is now Nepalese territory. He's born in his mother's territory, and then he's taken back to the home of the Shakyam clan in Kapilavastu. So this is, we'll call this boy Siddhartha. Apparently that's not his name. Scholars tell us that that's not his name. I was a bit disappointed. Apparently it means he who has achieved his aims, something like that. But it was given to him later on. So Siddhartha's early story has got all the hallmarks of the Battle of Good and Evil in it, really, hasn't it? It's got all the classic, archetypal effects. There's the prophecy. There's the palaces. And then there's his, as a young man, there is his insight into the inevitability of old age and suffering. And there's also the existential battle that rages within Siddhartha. Yes, there's the existential crisis and a real assertion, I don't want to become like my parents. Yeah? So I suppose I ask the question, can we relate to this? It seems contemporary, doesn't it? So there is a, but there is a, you know, joking aside, there is a very deep running existential dissatisfaction and disenchantment with the material world, with what he sees as the emptiness of the material world. So Siddhartha wants more. So he runs away. Now, again, there's a really strong mythical element being led through there. And I think that this running away is really important. He breaks out so that he can break free. Now, at the time, as you probably know, the Shramanera tradition was well established in the north of India. So to break out, to leave one's home and become a wandering searcher after the truth wasn't unheard of. But Siddhartha breaks free and he doesn't seek his family's blessing. Yeah, he breaks his covenant with them. He puts himself outside of the family, and I think that's important somehow. He starts his training. I'm going to skip over this because he's got two main teachers, Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta, but they're not as good as Master Yoda, so there's no point in going there. No? You don't get the good stuff in the swamps because they don't have it. Yeah, Luke Skywalker is learning from Master Yoda, and Yoda's got it. And Yoda can see that Luke's got it too. But Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta, they ain't got it. So there's Siddhartha's training, which I'm going to skip over. But there's one incident in his training that I love. And it's the story of Sujata. So Siddhartha has gone through, is it 2 years worth of austerity? Something really quite extreme. He's not been eating, and he's been practicing all these austerities, and he's been torturing his body, basically, with the belief that that's going to give rise, something's going to be liberated from that. And Sujata is a young girl who lives by the banks of the river, and she sees him in his emaciated form, and she just brings him back to life with simple food and common sense. Yeah, she just sees that it's that what he's doing is killing him. So she brings him a bowl of milk rice and she feeds him. And his natural intelligence knows that it's a question of taking the rice or dying. And he takes the rice and he goes for Sujata's common sense and he lives. So I think she's a lovely figure in the story of the Buddha's training, and she seems to be a little the small part of a girl walking through the struggle for good and evil. Speaking of evil, there's Mara. Yeah, there's Mara. So we skip to the Bodhi tree, and Siddhartha is doing really well at this point. He's given up his austerities. He's really set his intentions, and he's set himself down at the Bodhi tree to gain enlightenment. And Mara appears. Yeah, Mara. Mara's got another name. He's got a really cool demon name. Namuchi. Yeah? I love that. Namuchi. It means the non-releaser. Yeah? Because he won't let anybody escape from his clutches. Until now. So Siddhartha is getting close to enlightenment. Yeah? The sails are unfurled. Yeah? And he's sailing forth. And Mara appears. And Siddhartha is exemplified. Well, Siddhartha is on the path to liberation. Yeah, is on the path to liberation, and Mara tries to counter that with the weapon of doubt. And I think these are really an interesting pair of adversaries: liberation, self-liberation, and doubt. But first of all, Mara is actually. He's not aggressive at first. He doesn't pull any weapons. First of all, he's quite sympathetic, which I think is psychologically very interesting. First of all, Mara tries this. You are thin and pale. Why? You're near to death. My dear sir, do live. It's like Grima Wormtongue, isn't it, from the Lord of the Rings, yeah? My dear sir, do live. It is far better to live. I wonder what is all embedded in that word live. It is far better to live. You could accumulate merit if you stayed alive. You could lead the religious life, perform the offerings to the fire. It is a sure way to get lots of merit. What's the point of all this exertion? So that's Mara's first attack. What's the point of all this exertion? I'm sure we've asked ourselves that question from time to time. But as we know, when Mara assails the Buddha with the question of how dare he, well, we know what the Buddha does, don't we? He calls forth testimony from the earth. And I love this image. It's one of the images. Sometimes the Buddhist tradition throws up images that I feel something that's almost like pride in a positive way, you know, because they're so unexpected and lovely. Like the time after the Buddha's enlightenment where he stands for 7 days and gazes at the tree in sort of thankful respect. I love that image, you know, I sort of feel proud of it somehow. Anyway, what does the Buddha do? When Mara says, what right have you? The Buddha just very, very simply touches the earth. He just taps the ground, and the ground assures. Yeah, so the symbol is that the earth goddess rises, and she says that she's seen Siddhartha sit there many a time, and that he is heir to that spot. So it's confidence, yeah? It's confidence. And that image of the seated Buddha just touching the ground, just his fingers resting on the ground. It's a very central image in the iconography of the Buddha, and I think that's interesting, isn't it? Just that very simple gesture of confidence. And that's enough. That does it, really. There's this lovely phrase that you get for the banishment of Mara that you hear in different contexts, and it goes something like, just as a crow flying past spies on the ground a lump of fat. Do you know this one? Just as a crow spies a lump of fat and descends and then realises that it's a stone and so flies off. Just so is Mara defeated and slinks away, tossing aside his glute. So I love that. I love the lump of fat. There's something so visceral about that. So Mara is defeated by confidence. And by assuredness and a sense of stability. Somebody asked me recently at a class, it was just in the tea break of a class, and somebody came up to me and said, what is the most important teaching in Buddhism? I was just trying to have a cup of tea. But I said that I thought, in my opinion, that it was conditioned reproduction was the most important teaching in Buddhism. I don't know, what would your answer be?
Same.
So, yes, that was my kind of response. This being that becomes from the arising of this that arises. This not being that does not become from the ceasing of this that ceases. So I think that's what Siddhartha was referring to when he touched the earth in that way. He knew that the consequence of his wholehearted seeking after truth was that he would gain enlightenment, yeah? This being, that becomes. And I think he was just able to rely on that at that time. There's something so light about tapping the earth with the ends of your fingers, the lightness of it. So I've been talking about the Buddha, I've been talking about our Buddha, as it were. And for us, he's an exemplar, yeah? So the Buddha was born as we are born. What the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain. And the Buddha, one of the strengths about the Buddha is that we can really relate to him. We can relate to his humanity. For all his enlightened qualities, he seems like us in some respects. He goes through a process of unfoldment, of development, that we can relate to. We think, well, that's like us. And it's a path of human development. And he's exemplary as a teacher and as a guide and as a shower of the way. So this is one of the ways in which the Buddha is incredibly valuable to us as an exemplar. But actually, I want to talk about something completely separate from that. Yeah, I want to talk about, what I mentioned, the Buddha beyond Siddhartha. I want to talk about the Buddha, or rather, enlightenment, Buddhahood, as a principle, or even as a force in the universe. So we are obviously very aware of our Buddha, we call him that, our Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, and the story that starts with him as a Shakyamuni youth, and it goes through to the end of his life when he is a wise, compassionate master. And on his death, he leaves behind thousands of disciples, and probably hundreds of whom are enlightened. Yeah. And even in his death, there's poignancy there. He's still a very human figure in death. And you get that lovely moment where Ananda grieves. Ananda stands and grieves at the thought of losing the Buddha. So again, the human side, very strong. But again, I want to go beyond, I want to go behind this Buddha. So there's a theatre that the Buddhist tradition takes place within a particular theatre. Yeah, there's a scope, the scope of the Buddhist world, and it's vast. Yeah, so we tend to think enlightenment 2,500 years ago, Shakyamuni Buddha, oh, we can exemplify that. But actually, the theatre is vast, is much vaster than that. The scope is vast. So, in the first chapter of the survey, if you've ever studied the first chapter of the survey of Buddhism, there are these two sections. They're called the universal context and the cosmic perspective. And the cosmic perspective in particular draws this incredible picture for us of how time is viewed in the Buddhist tradition. So bear with me here. So, yes. Time in the Buddhist tradition is viewed as being comprised of these very, well, these extremely vast, lengthy periods of time known as world systems, or kalpas in Sanskrit, or kappas in Pali. And I'm going to call them kalpas because kappa sounds like a kind of leisure word. It's not good. Yes. So you've got these kalpas, yeah? So they are incalculable in length, yeah? And we are living in a kalpa, in an eon, yeah? That is embedded within a countless number of kalpas. So this is how the Buddhist tradition thinks about time. I'll give you a snip from the suttas about this. So a certain bhikkhu once asked how long the kalpa, or ordinary unit of measurement for vast periods of time, really was. The Lord replied, "Long indeed is the aeon, brother. It is not easy to reckon. It is not easy to reckon it in this way. So many years, so many centuries, so many millennia. So many 100,000 years. But can an illustration be given, Lord?" "It can, brother," replied the exalted one. "Just as if, brother, there were a mighty mountain crag, 4 leagues in length, height and breadth, without a crack or cranny." What's a crag? "Not hollowed out, one solid mass of rock, and a man should come at the end of every century with a cloth of Benares, and should once on each occasion stroke that rock. Sooner, brother, would that mighty mountain crag be worn away by this method, sooner be used up than the aeon. Thus long, brother, is the aeon. Of aeons thus long, many an aeon has passed away, many a hundred aeons, many a thousand aeons, many a hundred thousand aeons. So yes, the theatre is vast, the scope is vast. And, Douglas Adams. Let's have Douglas Adams. Yeah, he comes in naturally here, doesn't he? So this is him talking about space, but you can go and do it time. Space is big. You just won't believe how vastly, mind-bogglingly big it is. You think that going down to the chemist on the corner is a long way. But that's peanuts compared to space. Yeah? So, okay, but this is Buddhism, so there's lists. So there are four kinds of kalpas. Now, I'm not going to list them, but there are four kinds of kalpas. And it's got to do with universes coming, evolving, coming into being and dying away. What are called periods of evolution and periods of involution. World systems rising and declining. Now, why am I telling you this? Please. So within this vast expanse of time, something incredible happens. Yeah? Again and again and again. Something incredible happens. Within this vast expanse of time, Buddhas are born. Yeah? So we're in one kalpa, one aeon, which is embedded within a huge number of aeons. And within these different world systems, Buddhas arise. And they decline. Yeah? So our Buddha is one of a long lineage of Buddhas. Yeah? So a Buddha isn't really somebody who discovers the path to enlightenment. The Buddha is somebody who rediscovers the path to enlightenment. And that might seem like a tiny distinction, but I think it's significant. I think it's significant because what it means, this rediscovering, is that again within this very vast period, body of time, enlightenment is a continual possibility. Yeah? Within these vast expanses of time, enlightenment is continually a possibility for the beings living in those world systems. So in that way, enlightenment is like a force in the universe. So just as gravity is a force in the universe, enlightenment too is a force in that world system. So the Buddha, our Buddha, saw himself as the latest person in that lineage of enlightened ones. And when we had those readings this afternoon, Alison read that lovely reading about somebody who discovers an ancient road and follows that ancient road to a ruined city, which was the capital of an ancient kingdom. And that describes the path of a previous Buddha. Yeah, lovely image. So Shakyamuni, he has two families. He has an earthly family and he has a spiritual lineage. And he is the next heir in that spiritual dynasty. And this idea is taken up in the Buddhist scriptures that refer to Shakyamuni as this present Buddha, the Buddha of the present. And they also refer to Dipankara Buddha as being the previous Buddha before him, and Maitreya to being the next Buddha to come in a future aeon, in the next dispensation. So these vast periods of time allow for the Dharma to completely disappear off the face of the earth. Nobody knows about it. It's completely gone and dead. And then it re-emerges. Within these kalpas, you have what are called shunya kalpas, empty kalpas, where no Buddha appears. But then you have other kalpas where a Buddha arises. And you have some kalpas where you get two Buddhas. And some where you get three Buddhas. And it goes up to some kalpas where you get five Buddhas. There's Buddhas all over the place. Now, why is this important? Why am I highlighting this rather than just talking? Well, it's worse. I just talk about Shakyamuni and that'd be fine. For me, there is something really, really important about this, to do with in these very long periods of time, beings emerge who gain enlightenment. And there's something about this this potential for enlightenment in the universe. Yeah, it's not just got to do with the conditions that prevailed in North India 2,500 years ago. Yeah, where you've got particular tolerance to your religious life and a particular philosophical turn of mind. It's bigger than that. It's much vaster than that. It's got nothing to do with North India. It's got to do with the human spirit. Yeah. So enlightenment, human enlightenment, is being a force abroad in the universe, as being a principle, as being a universal principle that we can tap into. So for me, there's something important, there's something resonant about that, there's something deeply supportive about that, yeah? That enlightenment exists in the universe, whether people are practicing or not. It's just a possibility within the human heart. thinking about Shakyamuni Buddha, Buddhas have got characteristics. Is that a strange thing to say? Yeah, Buddhas have got different characters. Yeah, so our Buddha has got the qualities of the sage. Yeah, of the Muni. He is the Shakya Muni. Yeah. So what does that mean? It means that he likes to live in the forest. He likes to live simply. He likes to live as a wandering mendicant, yeah, with fewness of possessions. But it doesn't have to be like that. That's just the way Shakyamuni is. That's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it? What else would a Buddha be like? Don't know, skip on. So enlightenment is a force in the universe. I think this takes us back to this business of the battle for good and evil, yeah? whether we'd like it or not, whether we're trying to practice or not, there is a possibility for us of reversing our greed, our hatred, and our delusion at any time if we choose to align ourselves with that force, yeah? If we choose to tap into it. We just have to become aware of the possibility of tuning in to that force. Last year, Subhuti wrote this really good paper called Revering and Relying Upon the Dharma. And in that paper, he talked about the five niyamas. So these are five. Niyama means the order, an order of conditionality. What the heck does that mean? So the five niyamas, the five orders of conditionality. So a niyama, or an order of conditionality, is it's an aspect of the universe. It's an aspect of how things in the universe are conditioned. Yeah, it's the way in which particular things become conditioned, the way stuff arises. Yeah, the last of the five niyamas is relevant to what I'm saying here about enlightenment being a force in the universe. The last of the five niyamas, the Dhamma niyama, is the order of conditionality within which reality is made. The order of conditionality within which enlightenment is made possible. Yeah. So the Dharma niyama is that force. Yeah. That's what the Dharma niyama is. I suppose in the spiritual life, what we tend to do is we tend to be aware of the karma niyama. We tend to become aware that willed actions that are deliberately made have a positive effect, yeah, or a negative effect. And we try and work with, in ethics, what we do is we work with the karma niyama, yeah? There's this really nice simile, the stream entrant, yeah? So this is what a stream entrant is. A stream entrant is somebody like any of us here who's practicing the Dharma, and they're making effort, and they're making effort, willed effort, deliberate action, deliberate effort, say practicing the precepts. And what they do is, the simile is that they're in a wee boat, and that they're rowing along with their oars, and they're making an effort to practice the precepts. A And stream entry is when, at a certain point, they've got enough momentum going, they've got into the middle of the stream, and then they can hoik up a wee sail, yeah? And tie off the sail, and a wind catches that sail, and they glide along, yeah? And it becomes effortless. So they've made a heck of a lot of effort, let's not just forget that. They've made a heck of a lot of effort with sore arms. They've eaten a picnic. And they've entered the stream, yeah? They've entered the stream. Now, what entering the stream means is it means that their enlightenment is now guaranteed because they've made enough effort to break free. They've made enough effort to loosen, as it were, to loosen the free fetters or to weaken their greed, hatred, and ignorance. And they've built up enough momentum to be practicing the opposite of greed, hatred, and ignorance, yeah? So their wisdom and compassion is starting to be the motive force that propels them along. Now, if you look at it in terms of the Dharma Niyama, the stream is the Dharma Niyama, yeah? So when the wee person is in the boat rowing, like Bilyeu, they are subject to, that effort is subject to the Karma Niyama. When they put up their sail, that is then within the stream of the Dharma Niyama. So again, it's what I'm saying is that, I suppose I'm just talking about this because I find it really supportive to think that whether I'm making any effort or not, yeah, there are forces in the universe which support the attainment of enlightenment. Yeah. Now, if I'm not making any effort, then that doesn't really matter. You know, if I'm not making any effort, then there are French verbs in the world, but I'm not speaking them. But if I make the effort, those French verbs are open to me. If I make the effort, what I do is I align myself with those forces, yeah? I align myself with the good, yeah? So there's something about that, I think, that takes us beyond the loneliness of the individual striving to think of enlightenment as being a force in the universe or a principle in the universe. There's something there in a positive sense that I think that we can lean back into, yeah? Now, when the Buddha gained enlightenment, there's this lovely thing, it's this lovely little short sutta called the Garbha Sutta. And it goes, 7 days after the Buddha's enlightenment, he sat under the tree feeling gratitude for his experience. And he thought, well, what can I revere? It's a limitation to the human heart if you can't have respect and reverence for a thing. So what can I respect and revere? And he tries to think about different people who are worthy of that. And he can't think of anybody. And then he thinks, it's the Dharma. That's what I respect and revere, is the Dharma. So that's what the Buddha, in a sense, leans back into, is the Dharma. So, if the Dharma Niyama is the condition within the universe that makes enlightenment possible, then our relationship to that is a very particular relationship. We have to realise that we can't control these conditions, yeah? We can't manipulate them, yeah? We just partake in them. What we can control is, what we do have control over are our actions and our responses within the play of the Karma Niyama. But in terms of the Dharma Niyama, in terms of the Dharma as a force or reality, we can't really control that. We to some extent, we have to surrender to that. Yeah. But through practicing ethics and through developing faith, we can partake of this force in the universe. So faith in particular, I say, because faith is the start of the spiral path, yeah? And the spiral path would be a way in which we could see the Dharma Niyama having an effect on us in the world, yeah? Maybe the spiral path is a bit like what the Dharma Niyama looks like. Maybe that's how it would act upon us, say, in meditation. Yeah? So from a sense of faith arises joy, yeah, arises rapture, calm, bliss, concentration. Yeah? There's a sense of that So that requires quite a lot of developing quite a bit of sensitivity, yeah, quite a bit of receptivity, just to get a bit of a sense of what that is like to align ourselves with that force in the universe. So for me, there's a really great example of somebody who has aligned himself to the principle of Buddhahood, the principle of enlightenment at large in the universe, and that is Pingala. Yeah, I think he's a great example of somebody who's leaned back, yeah, into that force, leaned back into that wind, as it were. So I'm going to finish with Pingala. This is from, for those of you who don't know this, this is from the Sutta Nipata, which is some of the very earliest verses in the Pali Canon come from here. They're short and they're really accessible. And Pingala is a recluse who has been talking about his teacher, the Buddha, who he's separated from. He doesn't live within the Buddha's community. And he's talking with reverence about the Buddha, and the person that he's talking to says in a slightly sneering way, "Well, if you think he's so good, why don't you just go and live with him?" We all have these kind of conversations, don't we? But Pingala, why then don't you spend all your time, your every moment with this man Gotama, this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher whose Dhamma is the way things are, instant, immediate, invisible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, and with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world? "Brahmin sir," said Pingala, "there is no moment for me, however small, that is spent away from Gotama, from this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher, whose teaching is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world. You see, sir," said Pingala, "with constant and careful vigilance, it is possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, in night as well as day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not to my mind a single moment spent away from him. I cannot now move away from the teaching of Gotama. The powers of confidence and joy, of intellect and awareness, hold me there. Whichever way this universe of wisdom goes, it draws me with it. Physically, I cannot move like that. My body is decaying. I am old and weak. But the driving power of purposeful thought propels me without break. There was once a time, writhing in the mud of the swamps, I could only drift from one stone to the next, but then I saw the Sambuddha, fully awake and free from defilement. Then the Buddha spoke. Pingala," he said, "other people have freed themselves by the power of confidence. Vakali, Vajravutta and Alavi Gotama have all done this. You too should let that strength release you. You too will go to the further shore beyond the draw of death." "These words," said Pingala, "are the words of a man of wisdom. As I hear them, I become more confident. This man is Sambuddha. He has opened the curtains and woken up. There is nothing barren there. His mind is clear and luminous. Everything accessible to knowledge is known to him, even the ultimate subtleties of Godhood. There are no more questions for the doubtful who come to him. The teacher has answered them all. Yes, I shall go there. I shall go beyond change. I shall go beyond formations. I shall go beyond comparison. There are no more doubts. You may consider this as mind released."